Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Boston University's Pardee Center for the Study of the Longer Range Future recently sponsored a two-day symposium titled The Future of Space Exploration, Solutions to Earthly Problems. Experts from around the nation gathered to discuss issues such as the future of commercial space, the future of science, peace and security, and extraterrestrial life. Our two speakers tonight were part of a session called The Future of Human Spaceflight. Former U.S. Senator and Apollo 17 astronaut Dr. Harrison Schmitt is current chair of the NASA Advisory Council. He'll speak a bit later on realism in the expansion of the Earth's economic sphere to include the moon. First, we hear from Professor Freeman Dyson, professor emeritus with the Institute for Advanced Studies in Princeton, New Jersey, speaking on honest marketing of human activities in space.
No, I had a startling experience just about 3 days ago. I got an email from Baikonur, from my daughter, who happened to be there with her friend Charles Simonyi and watch him go up. And that's an example of something I couldn't have conceived as possible 50 years ago when she was a five-year-old. And why was she there? Because she's a venture capitalist. She's a professional. She thinks there's money to be made in this business. And she was actually near enough to the launch to feel the heat. So the Russians, of course, are much less fussy about security than we are. They're not quite as paranoid. They let the tourists come and actually climb over the rocket before they launch. And the spectators can be as close as they want, just as long as they don't get roasted. This is something that I think is in a way the wave of the future, that human spaceflight has to be honestly marketed. That's the subject of my talk. The reason it's run consistently into political trouble is that it was always sold under false pretenses. And I just give you one example of that. I was on a committee to evaluate the International Space Station right at the start when it was first proposed. And this committee was advising OTA, that was called Office of Technology Assessment, which was an organ of the United States Congress. We were supposed to be independent of NASA. We were advising the Congress as to whether this International Space Station made sense. And it was being sold under false pretenses as being something that would be useful for science. Well, the chairman of our committee was Carl Sagan. We had various other sensible people on board. And we sat for 3 days listening to proposals for exciting science that could be done on the station. And so we had proposals from NASA, we had proposals from the aerospace industry. And altogether, 48 examples of wonderful experiments that could be done on the station. And so we listened to all these people and we made notes and we evaluated what these proposals actually implied. And at the end, then, on the third day, we went down the list very carefully. We had these 48 experiments. We decided, more or less unanimously, that 46 of them could be done better without the space station for various reasons, mostly because they required different kinds of orbits or because they required a longer duration observations, also for all kinds of reasons. For most of the space experiments, a free-flying platform would have been better. And for a number of them, they'd be better done on the ground. And there are all sorts of reasons, anyway, for not doing them on the space station. The two that remained from the list were observations of the effects of living on the station on the crew. Biomedical experiments that required long-duration flight. So for those, we all agreed the station would be useful. Anyhow, so at the end of that day, then we sat down and we decided it was time to write our report. And then the official who had convened the meeting declared us to be adjourned. And so Sagan protested and said, but aren't we going to write the report? And the OTA man said, oh, I'm sorry, you didn't understand. You don't get to write the report. We get to write the report. So, in fact, the report was written by some staffer at OTA and said exactly the opposite of what we had wanted. So that was how the thing got sold. Well, of course, the history is full of such incidents. When you look at the possible functions of humans in space, because roughly speaking, there are three major interests involved. There's science, there's the military, and there's commercial industry. And if you look, you see that none of them actually wanted the space station. The military had its own manned space project called the Manned Orbiting Laboratory, which limped along for some years and then very wisely was terminated. The military couldn't think of anything really useful for people to do in space. When I look at the beginnings, I'm thinking particularly of the Wernher von Braun, who was, in a way, the progenitor of everything we're doing. He published a book in 1952, I think it was a year earlier in Germany. It appeared in 1952 in English, called The Mars Project, which was a complete description of a human expedition to Mars. And it was done in the style of the Berlin Airlift, essentially. The Berlin Airlift was, of course, fresh in everybody's minds at that time. Von Braun himself had been a spectator. And we saw at the time of the Berlin Airlift that it was possible to fly very large quantities of materials very fast on a regular schedule to keep the city of Berlin alive for about a year. And that was the sort of the prototype for von Braun's Mars project, that you would have something which he called the shuttle, which was the progenitor of the actual shuttle, which would make four flights every day into orbit and back. Four flights every day. That was roughly on the scale of the Berlin Airlift. And that's what he had in mind. If you did it fast enough and with large enough volume, it would become cheap. And that, of course, is still true. So he had this fleet of shuttles flying stuff into orbit. In a couple of years, you could get, I don't have all the numbers here, the orders of millions of tons of cargo launched from the ground. And then you'd have a fleet of interplanetary transport vehicles. I think there are 10 of those, which would take stuff from Earth orbit into Mars orbit. And then you'd have a fleet of, I think, 10 landers, which would take stuff down from Mars orbit onto the ground. And in the end, you'd have then 50 humans on Mars with enough materials to support them for about 5 years. And the model for how they would operate was precisely Darwin on the Beagle. The idea was there would be somebody there who would discover something really important. And, of course, the picture was that you'd stay there for a long time. You'd have time to really to get deeply involved. So these operations would continue for about 5 years. The total bandwidth for communication with Earth was 2 kilobytes per second, so not quite enough for a telephone conversation. So it would essentially have been just telegraphy, sending messages by Morse code. So that the results of the exploring would be brought home at the end of the 5 years, just like Darwin on the Beagle. You'd come home with it all in your heads and then tell the world what you'd discovered. And somehow or other, that picture has dominated our thinking ever since. And of course, meanwhile, technology moved in the opposite direction. I myself was involved with another enterprise in the late 50s, called Project Orion. Project Orion was a nuclear bomb-propelled spacecraft which we designed and promoted at the same time that the Apollo program was getting started. So it was, in fact, in competition with Apollo. It was a cheaper and much more powerful way of getting people into space. Orion ship would have gone to Mars and to the satellites of Jupiter and Saturn within a period of about 10 years. I mean, our motto was Saturn by 1970, and that's about what we would have done. The project started in 19, 58, just a few months after Sputnik. It was made possible because of Sputnik. And our idea of going to Mars, of course, was just like von Braun's. We were going to go there ourselves. I was, in fact, fully intending to go as part of the crew. And we would have trudged around on Mars in the same way as Darwin in exploring the Galapagos Islands, writing down our observations in notebooks. It would have been a wonderful trip, and I regret very much not having gone. But it actually wouldn't have had much to do with science. And today, looking back on that, of course, the project was killed in the end because of the problem of nuclear contamination, that these bombs are infernally messy and they contaminate the entire planet with radioactive debris. So that was a good reason for not doing it. But quite apart from that, suppose we had today a clean version of Orion, which somehow or other didn't contaminate the landscape. It could carry a payload of 1,000 tons, and it could take us cheaply around the solar system. I don't know what we would do with it. We don't have any missions that require 1,000 tons payload. The whole thing has been sidetracked so totally by the development of microelectronics. Microelectronics just is a totally new world. And we have now, of course, gigabytes of bandwidth where we used to have kilobytes. And a factor of a million really does make a difference. It's hard to imagine what we would do with the sort of payloads we then were talking about. Another thing I'd like to talk about is the military uses of Orion, which is sort of another object lesson. We had to pretend that Orion was a military program because it was paid for by the Air Force. And according to law, the Air Force is not supposed to support anything that doesn't have a military mission. So we had to invent a military mission for Orion. And what it ended up by being something very undesirable called the Deep Space Deterrent Force. And so you had Orion ships which were circling deep, deep in space, way beyond the moon, loaded with hundreds of hydrogen bombs, ready to launch at all kinds of targets all over the Earth, just like the Trident submarines are today. The only difference, really, between this Deep Space Force and the Trident is that the Deep Space Force would have had a 24-hour transit time, whereas the Tridents only have 40 minutes. Anyhow, this Deep Space Deterrent Force was actually proposed as a serious alternative. This was before the days of submarine-launched ballistic missiles. And the general in charge of the General Power, who was then in charge of the Strategic Air Command, fell in love with this. He thought it was a great idea. He proclaimed very loudly, "Who controls Orion will control the world." And so he had dreams of grandeur, probably manning one of these ships himself. Fortunately, he showed that there was a model was built of this Deep Space Deterrent Force, and it was shown to President Kennedy by General Power himself with great pride, and Kennedy was totally dismissive. It was the last thing he wanted. So that put an end to the military uses of Orion. You don't need manned space for anything military any more than you do for science. And finally, of course, there was this fiasco of the commercial uses of space. I mean, the commercial uses of people in space. We have wonderful commercial operations in space, communication satellites and all kinds of commercial satellites, which make a profit every week. But the commercial companies understood right away from the beginning that they didn't need people in space and they'd be much better off without it. My message is that the reason why manned space is in such bad shape is it has been sold under false pretenses. And what it really ought to be and what it has been when it was in its most successful moments was an international sporting event. And that's what it should be, and that's what it will be. That the public is always willing to spend more on sport than it spends on science. And that's why manned space has flourished, because it is a sporting event when it's done well. If you look at Apollo, which is a case which where it was done well, you'll observe the first thing that was unloaded on each of the landings was the television camera. That was actually the main purpose of the exercise. That's what it was all about. It was good television, and it actually was enormously successful. When I remember viewing those programs, of course, the fact that people could land on the moon wasn't anything, it wasn't surprising. The fact that the spacecraft got there and the people walked around, well, that's something we'd expected. What I'd not expected is that we would see it ourselves in the living room. That was something that was a big surprise. And that was, of course, the great achievement of Apollo. It brought space down to Earth. And we see it today, of course, with these tourist flights. It's quite astonishing, something I had not expected, that some rational being, somebody whom I actually respect, like Charles Simonyi, would want to spend $25 million just on a tourist trip. But it's true, that's where he is. He's right up there now, circling around and enjoying the view. And that's something we have to make use of. That's where the future is. But I'd like to end my talk by saying, don't make plans for 50 years ahead on the assumption things are going to be the same. I mean, it's absurd. The reason why the world today is totally different from 50 years ago is because of microelectronics. We have cell phones, we have the internet, the whole world is totally different just because of this one particular invention. Well, there are going to be at least two more similar inventions in the next 50 years. I don't know what they are, but I just make wild guesses. And the most obvious, I would say, is biotech. That biotechnology is sort of roughly in the same phase today as microelectronics was 50 years ago. That 50 years ago, of course, we still thought of computers as being huge, bulky, expensive, and only for use by experts. And von Neumann himself, who invented this sort of, didn't invent electronic computers, but he invented software, basically. He invented the idea of programming the operation of the computer into its own memory. So he invented programmable electronic computers. And he was once asked, how many computers will the United States need? And he answered, 18. So he had absolutely no conception that the thing would ever get cheap and small. He thought of computers as being huge instruments in the hands of governments or major industries or government laboratories. And he saw them getting bigger and bigger rather than smaller and smaller. Well, I would say if things go well, the same thing is going to happen to biotech. At the moment, biotech is widely distrusted because it's in the hands of big companies like Monsanto, and it's being used to put genes for poisonous pesticides into food crops. It's generally considered to be undesirable. That's going to change. That biotech is going to go the other way. It'll become domesticated, user-friendly, cheap, and small. And that will make the whole enterprise of bringing life into space totally different. I mean, the idea that manned operations are going to stay in the style that they are today, I would say, is extremely unlikely. I mean, if they stay like the way they are today, people will get tired of them and they'll simply die. They've got to change in order to survive. And I would imagine 50 years from now, if there are people living on Mars, it'll be a much more mundane and sort of domesticated operation than anything that you have in mind. And the other thing, of course, which is likely to happen in 50 years, is we'll have radically new launch systems. There, I'm thinking, of course, of the airplane, which progressed from the Wright brothers to worldwide transcontinental flights to in about 50 years. And I see the same thing could happen with space launch. But what has to happen, of course, is you have to have a high volume of traffic. It's a chicken and egg problem. In order to make aircraft, flying by aircraft cheap, you had to have lots of passengers. And to have lots of passengers, it has to be cheap. But the thing can grow. It can grow with help from governments. But I foresee that, I mean, in the case of space launches, something like a laser propulsion space launch system is going to emerge. What is laser propulsion? It simply means you have a large laser sitting on top of a mountain pointing up into space, and the space that laser beam, which is about a gigawatt of power, is a public highway. So if you want to go into space, all you do is to bring your little launch vehicle, which is something about the size of a small automobile, carrying a ton of water as propellant, and it has a rocket engine which is simply using water as propellant, but using the energy of the laser as the power source. So you detach the power source from the vehicle, and so your little vehicle rides up the beam, and there you are, and you can go to escape from Earth. And it costs you about $10,000 for a ton of payload. That's just the cost of the laser. And if you can launch every 5 minutes, 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, it's cheap. If you only launch 10 vehicles a year, of course, it's monstrously expensive. So the question is, how do you get from here to there? First of all, you have to have some place to go. At the moment, if you had a launch every 5 minutes, there'd be nowhere for any of these vehicles to go. There would just be a graveyard up in space. So you've got to have the whole infrastructure already in place. There has got to be a big repair shop of some sort, or a couple of big hotels already there, either in orbit or on the moon or on Mars. The whole thing has to grow together. Cheap launch has to go together with the large tourist industry, which will provide enough passengers to make the thing commercial. But that's the kind of future that I see for man in space. I think it's going to happen, but probably not the way I'm describing it, but something quite different from what we're doing today. Thank you very much.
Professor Freeman Dyson, Professor Emeritus with the Institute for Advanced Studies in Princeton, New Jersey, speaking on Honest Marketing of Human Activities in Space, part of a recent two-day symposium sponsored by Boston University's Pardee Center for the Study of the Longer-Range Future. The symposium was titled The Future of Space Exploration, Solutions to Earthly Problems. You're listening to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Now, from the same symposium, we hear from former U.S. Senator and Apollo 17 astronaut and current chair of the NASA Advisory Council, Dr. Harrison Schmitt, speaking on realism in the expansion of the Earth's economic sphere to include the moon.
Let me quickly take a perspective on the past, and I'll try to do this quite quickly, so you may have to read fast. But basically, there was a significant set of legacies from Apollo. The Cold War legacy, you could call that the political legacy, if you will. Goals of Eisenhower and Kennedy to advertise free institutions on this planet were clearly met by Apollo. And spacefaring became an international imperative. I think you heard that from the President of India today. And it has indeed, for many nations and many peoples, become extremely important to their future. There was a societal legacy as well. We gained a new evolutionary status on this planet. We've found that the human species can live on the moon and Mars, that the resources are there to support our species independently of the Earth once they are established there. And that, I think, is a very important, if you will, philosophical context in which to view what Apollo had done as a demonstration. There has been and was, as a consequence of the technology development stimulated by Apollo and the competition in which it was related, with the acceleration of technological expansion, hazard definition and risk determination, and many other aspects that directly or indirectly improve the human condition on Earth. We did, in two major ways, identify some potential progress with respect to Earth energy supplies. We certainly, with the space business internationally as well as in the United States, the conversion of energy from one form to another for useful purposes was significantly enhanced in terms of its efficiency. You have to do that in order to even make it to the moon, or much less into Earth orbit. And we identified at least two major new potential power options for the Earth in the long term. One is the lunar helium-3 fusion, I'll speak a little bit more about in a few moments, and solar power, both of which need to be looked at very carefully, space solar power, and those kinds of economic trades I'm sure will be done sometime in the future. And also, maybe more importantly for the long term, and possibly important to some young people alive today, depending on how fast things progress, we identified the resources that they will need in order to live independently of the Earth on the moon, and ultimately to get set up on Mars. Now, there was an extraordinary scientific legacy. In spite of what impression that might have been left by some today, we did gain a first-order understanding of the origin and evolution of the moon, one of the M-members, along with the Earth, of the terrestrial planet system. And without that that history book, if you will, of the moon, we would be much, much more ignorant, not only about our own Earth and its early history, but certainly about Mars and the potential history of the other planets. That understanding was a basis for the interpretation of post-Apollo information about the moon, the robotic missions that have been launched and have been extraordinarily successful. And that, in turn, became the foundation for a new discipline of comparative planetology, which is one of the most active scientific disciplines today, at least so far on this planet. Just as one example of the importance of the moon to that study of comparative planetology, its initial guide to the early history of the Earth and Mars, that is an early history that we are still struggling to define here on Earth. It's sometimes referred to the Hadean. We have no benchmarks directly available to us here on Earth, although some are coming from the study of ancient zircons. But it is ultimately the dating of the major impacts on the moon that I believe are going to provide those benchmarks necessary to understand not just the Hadean, not just that early part of Earth history down to about 3.8 billion years ago, but the part of Earth history in which life and its precursors were being formed and evolving. That also included now is that we define that lunar resource potential that I mentioned previously, and delineated the future scientific potential of the moon. I can't help but mention that the NASA Advisory Council that I currently chair sponsored a major conference in Tempe, Arizona, just a few weeks ago, in which that was basically the subject. And I can safely say that all of the disciplines, space science-related disciplines, represented at that conference found, some to their surprise, that there were major new potentials for a return to the moon, even within their disciplines, some having come there thinking there were none. All of this I find truly remarkable for a program that started out, as we have seen, with a very clear political Cold War purpose, in which ultimately, through the wisdom of a variety of NASA managers, not the least of which was George Lowe and Sam Phillips, it developed into a scientific exploration program, a field exploration program, if you will, with the deployment also of a number of very fine experiments on the moon, fine for their time, and some of which, as you probably are aware, are still, one of which at least, is still very active, and that's the Lunar Corner Reflector experiment that is continuing to refine many aspects of our understanding, not just of the moon, but also of the motions of the crust. And it has identified a potential, long-term, to do some very fundamental physics confirmations of Einstein's theory of relativity. If we can add to that that array of corner reflectors that we now have on the moon. The keys to Apollo's success are very important to understand, I think, because any major human endeavor, anything comparable in scale, is not only going to require that in the future, but I think you can find elements of these keys in all major successful human activities on Earth, and you can find elements of their absence in those activities, major activities that might be considered failures. Certainly, you must have a sufficient base of technology, World War II, the Cold War, and some very important decisions made by President Eisenhower in his last year, a year and a half of tenure as President of the United States, all contributed to that base of technology. I bring Eisenhower's decisions into this. They were extraordinarily important because in January of 1960, he directed Keith Glennon, the then administrator of NASA and the first administrator of NASA, to proceed with the development of a super booster, which became the Saturn V. He also, in that context, after some significant resistance by the U.S. Army, as you might expect, he succeeded, or he told von Braun and his group, the Army Missile Agency, to move into NASA, and that became, of course, the Marshall Space Flight Center. So in addition to the response to the Sputnik launch, which created NASA from the old National Advisory Committee on Aeronautics, Eisenhower made a very fundamental decision that indeed provided credibility to what came later from a young president that followed him. There also, of course, was a reservoir of young engineers and skilled workers available to us, fortuitously sponsored in a way by the launch of Sputnik, and they were young. The people who made Apollo a success were in their 20s, and they had already been involved for years in this program, fresh out of the engineering schools of the United States, many out of the engineering schools of Europe. These people were absolutely phenomenal, and they were young, and you have to remember that. That is the essential core ingredient, I think, of any successful major program, is to have that imagination, that motivation, and maybe most importantly, the stamina that comes with young people who are in their 20s. There's a pervasive environment of national unease that was around at the time. A few of us are old enough to remember the campaign of 1960 in which John Kennedy emphasized the so-called missile gap between the United States and the then Soviet Union. In fact, I think in retrospect, you can't probably support the claim that there was a missile gap. There was a great deal going on in this country. But nevertheless, it was a part of an emphasis on the general unease that existed not only here, but I think throughout the world, about the inevitable continuation of the Cold War. That was a major, major factor of unease, at least in the United States at the time. And then, of course, the famous catalytic event that's already been mentioned today that brought focus to the effort, or at least gave Kennedy a way to bring political focus to the effort. It turns out that John Kennedy was already talking about a major leap forward in space in March of 1961. Had conversations with Bob Gilruth, who was then the leader of the Space Task Group, and became the head of the Manned Space Craft Center in Houston, and many others within NASA, to see if there wasn't something that could move forward. And Gagarin's flight became the basis then to articulate what Kennedy already had in the back of his mind, a very important thought, and that was to take Americans to the moon and return them safely to Earth. And with that, we had an articulate and trusted persuasive president who could indeed begin such a endeavor. Also, you can't forget how important the last bullet here is, and that is that you have developed a tough, competent, and disciplined management organization that can make an endeavor of this complexity and of this magnitude successful. We almost had that management system in place before the Apollo 204 or Apollo 1 fire that killed Gus Grissom and his crew, but not quite. there was, in certain areas, there was a lack of discipline that hadn't really been realized yet as going to be essential in order to meet the challenge that John Kennedy had given us. But with that fire, that system was in place, and indeed without it, it's a heck of a way to learn how to do things right, is through the death of three fine men. But nevertheless, without that fire, I suspect we would not have met the challenge, that a serious accident would have occurred some other time in the future with much greater consequences, possibly in space itself. Now, I remind you that probably most major human endeavors require this, but deep space operations still require these keys to be present. What was the largest mistake after Apollo? Well, it's already been hinted at, and basically one way to put it in economic terms is we did not amortize the cost of the Apollo development. We flew through Apollo 17, abandoned much of the hardware for several more missions, and we just left it. Had we continued to use the Saturn Apollo capabilities, we could have provided a number of things. Periodic access to the moon, the capability for asteroid and comet diversion. You know, for a very brief period in human history, the Saturn V provided us the access to comets and asteroids. And we're still sitting here wondering what we're going to do with the consequences of that particular hazard, a very immense hazard, very low risk, but immense hazard in terms of consequences. And before too long, it is hoped we will have that capability back again with the Ares system. The Skylab-style station for characterization of human adaptation to microgravity, we started that process. Indeed, if you go back and review the research protocol pre, during, and post mission of the Skylab biomedical experiments, they are the best that's ever been done, absolutely the best that's ever been done. I told John Glenn, I said, you know, we shouldn't have flown you in space again. We should have flown all these Skylab astronauts in space again because we have a database on them. We don't know anything about you and what you were like when you were flying previously. But he doesn't like that particular suggestion, as you might expect. I am still convinced there are many other microgravity applications. We just haven't been clever enough to realize what they all are. It is a brand new environment, and I just can't believe that a brand new environment, microgravity, is not something we're going to find extraordinarily useful in the future. An enhancement of those capabilities, had we continued to mature the system and add to it, would have provided us with a low-cost access, I believe, to lunar resources that were identified, actually, the importance of which were identified 13 years after Apollo. By the Wisconsin group, basis for large-scale robotic and human exploration of Mars. All of these things could have come out of that particular endeavor. Now, why return to the moon? A very, very important question. It's one that the president convinced himself that was important, along with the building the capability to re-enter deep space and to be a significant player in that continuing new environment. Well, basically, I think it comes down to satisfying basic human instincts for exploration, however you may define it. Human beings, modern humans, for at least the last 40,000 years, have moved across this planet looking for freedom, possibly, certainly betterment, and I'm sure curiosity was not a small factor in that, if they're anything, and I suspect they're very much like us. New homelands and trade and knowledge came with that and probably stimulated some of those migrants. It continues at least 40,000 years of providing the benefits of exploration to modern humans. The new homes, livelihoods, know-how and resources, both in space and here on Earth, supported both by government and private institutions. I put government in quotes here on this particular chart because sometimes the decisions were made collectively, such as tribal decisions to move from one place to another, to new agricultural lands, and that can be expanded to this nation state of the kind of decisions that were made to go forward with Apollo and are now going forward with other endeavors in space by many different nations. and to perpetuate the settlement of space. I really feel that that's extraordinarily important for the human species. All other species tend to, for the most part, seek to expand their habitat for survival. I see no reason why we should be any different. And having this human species established on the Moon and Mars in the long term, I think it will be extraordinarily positive for the continuation of the species over the long term, as we try to then, and later on, at least seed the galaxy with our particular life form. And of course, it is always there that opportunity for the expansion of free institutions. There is a correlation between that and the existence of settlements on other planets. You know, we talk about what kind of governance system would you have for a lunar settlement or a Martian settlement of some kind. Well, those settlements are going to decide what their governance system is going to be. And more than likely, we will get a message someday from a settlement on the Moon that's been producing helium-3 for a few decades for us and say, well, you know, we're tired of taxation without representation. And we're going to go our own way. We'll continue to supply you, but here's what the new price structure is going to be. That kind of thing will happen, and Jefferson's little revolution will indeed have finally occurred. We have many, many different challenges, but the one I want to mention is energy supply. We're looking in 2050 at something like 10 to 12 billion Earthlings. We really have to find ways to increase the, not only to substitute energy supply, one energy supply for another, but to increase the total amount of energy that's available on this planet. I see absolutely no way to avoid that reality. And of course, those that feel that we are going to need to mitigate the effects of climate change, and I would say it's going to change geologically. We all know it's going to change. But the one constant factor is to deal with the adverse consequences of climate change, you're going to need more energy. Whether it gets warmer and then cooler or cooler and then warmer, you're going to need energy to deal with those adverse consequences. Believe me, if we deal with the development of the economic development and betterment of the human condition on Earth, you've got to deal with finding new energy supplies. Fossil fuels, it's going to be there. We're going to have to use it for a long time. But I would certainly be among those that say you ought to phase it out as fast as you can, but be realistic about it. It isn't going to disappear very fast, and in fact, before we're through, we're going to need a lot more than we have right now. In fact, it's more valuable in the long term to the human species as a natural chemical, as natural chemicals, than it is as fuel. So you need to keep that in mind. Certainly, fission power is going to be important. It is the safest kind of power that you can have today, in spite of what people may feel. And many nations, including France and Japan and others, and China now more and more, are moving towards a very aggressive use of fission power. Solar energy, certainly on a regional basis, is going to be important. And by solar, I'm talking about all the various stored forms of solar energy, wind, biofuels, and the like. But there are limits to how broadly that will be available to us. A portfolio of energy sources, of course. That's what we have right now, and we're just going to have to expand that. And the one thing that I think is absolutely critical to the long term is to look at fusion power. And in that, there is a role for space. It is, of course, lunar helium-3 fusion power. And in deference to Rusty and his asteroids, I will say that the economic trade studies of looking at the lunar regolith as a source of helium-3 versus asteroid regoliths has not been done and should be done. This is actual helium-3 fusion power, deuterium helium-3 fusion power, taking place in a steady state in the laboratories at the University of Wisconsin. It is, in this particular case, it's only a small electrostatic device, and there is a strategy for working through to actually create demonstration plants of one or more ways of using dehelium-3 in electrostatic confinement devices, not just the IEC device. Now, what about the resource base? Well, the undisturbed grade for Apollo 11 helium-3, that is in the Mare Tranquillitatis region, is probably around 20 parts per billion. That may not sound very much, but 1,000 megawatt, gigawatt fusion power plant, dehelium-3 fusion power plant, would require about 100 kilograms of helium-3 per year. That's actually more, but when you take inventory into account and other issues, let's just use that as a simplified way of doing some calculations. To produce 100 kilograms of helium-3 would require mining about two square kilometers to a depth of 3 meters over a year, and processing the half of that, the about 50% by weight, which is the less than 100 micron fraction, where most of your solar wind volatiles are contained. And that 100 kilograms of helium-3 has a steam coal equivalent value of about $140 million if you compare it to coal at $2.50 a million BTU. So it is an extraordinarily potentially valuable resource. The question is, what is the cost going to be to get it? And also, is it reasonable to even propose getting it based on space law? There was some conversation this morning about international laws that applies to space. There is one fundamental treaty. It's the Outer Space Treaty of 1967. As mentioned earlier, it is over 100 nations. All the spacefaring nations are signatories of this treaty, and it is in operation. This 1967 treaty, though, is permissive relative to access to space resources. It creates a framework unlike and indeed derived from the Antarctic Treaty in some ways. It came after that treaty and did benefit from the international discussions that led to the Antarctic Treaty regime. But it is permissive, and private, government, multilateral, international initiatives are all equally permissible under the Outer Space Treaty. There also is the potential for a multilateral private property regime to be established, and it probably would be desirable in this context. The Outer Space Treaty does, of course, prevent any nation from claiming sovereignty over any celestial body, including the moon or an asteroid or anything else. But the demonstration of a commercial viability of a helium-3 fusion looks like about a $5 billion capital investment to reach a demonstration plant, the recreation of a Saturn V class of heavy lift boosters with a payload cost at about $3,000 a kilogram to the moon. That's a factor 20 less than Apollo, the one-off cost of a Saturn Apollo system. And we don't know right now how the Ares 1 and 5 development is going to feed into that, and whether that could be refined to the point of where it could reach those kinds of payload costs. That would take about a $5 billion investment. And then to actually create the miner processors, infrastructure, and indeed the company town, if you will, of settlers, that is necessary to produce the helium-3, that's probably something on the order of a $2.5 billion investment, but could be reduced with the taking advantage of the lunar outpost architecture that is under consideration and development now by NASA. Again, that is all financially viable. That envelope would be, you could stay within that envelope with a price of coal as your principal competitor, at about $2.50 a million BTUs. Now, spot prices of coal have gone up since that. Sometimes some of them are higher than that number. And so any time the price of coal goes up, we do a little bit better. Management control diagram. Remember, I'm an old geologist, and I think in terms of component diagrams. And this particular three-component diagram of private, national, and international components is a useful figure. I'm not going to go through it, but it gives you an idea of the kinds of options we have, and human beings, remarkably, have tried just about everything to manage major programs, and certainly national programs down there in the lower left, the Trans-Alaska Pipeline was largely a private program, and indeed, in about the same scale, $15 billion in today dollar investment. The purely international programs tend not to fare very well. At least not in my analysis. It makes it very, very difficult to manage large-scale international cooperative programs. But ladies and gentlemen, if a Helium-3 initiative began in 2007 with assured funding, very important, that's one of the reasons why we have looked at the private initiative so carefully, is we think it has more reliable funding potential than a government initiative. The first human mission to Mars could be launched by 2020. In my humble opinion, because you would have developed the infrastructure. on the backs of Helium 3, paid for by Helium 3, and you'd have all of that infrastructure ready to go. And this, by the way, Dr. Dyson, would include, I think, a clean fusion Orion. That is very possible. If you want an interplanetary rocket system to cut the travel time to anywhere, particularly to Mars, then a mirrored fusion system is probably what you're going to, a helium-3 fusion system is probably going to do it. But in the meantime, the Earth, of course, would have another alternative source of environmentally acceptable electrical power. Well, ladies and gentlemen, it is my humble opinion that Apollo broke the psychological, technological, and survival bonds that hold us to the Earth. This new evolutionary potential in the universe permits us to live on the moon and indeed to live on Mars. Generations alive today, that's the young people in this audience primarily, can determine if humankind will take advantage of this new evolutionary status. The question I ask you is, will we begin the settlement of the solar system and provide for a new birth of freedom beyond the Earth? Thank you very much.
Former U.S. Senator and Apollo 17 astronaut and current chair of the NASA Advisory Council, Dr. Harrison Schmidt. Dr. Schmidt spoke about realism in the expansion of the Earth's economic sphere to include the moon. Earlier, we heard from Professor Freeman Dyson, professor emeritus with the Institute for Advanced Studies in Princeton, New Jersey, speaking on honest marketing of human activities in space. Both lectures were from a recent two-day symposium sponsored by Boston University's Pardee Center for the Study of the Longer Range Future. The symposium was titled The Future of Space Exploration: Solutions to Earthly Problems. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. CDs are $15, which includes shipping and handling. Tonight's program was produced by Tim Skov with help from Mike Toda and Michelle Tash. Our web producer is Angel Cazelli. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.